Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and once again, we're joined by David Kittle. David is the Senior Director of Industry Relations for IMARC, a fraud investigation company located in Santa Ana, California. He manages IMARC's Washington, D.C. office. He's a past chairman of MBA's Political Action Committee, MORPAC, and former vice chairman of MBA's Residential Board of Governors. He also served on MBA's Board of Directors from 2004 to 2010. And David's a past chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association in Washington, D.C., completing his term in October of 2009. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Bruce. It's great to be here.
We had just off-air talked a little bit about some of the loans that, should have been easy to get funded, and it haven't been. And I mentioned it seems like there's a conveyor belt A and everything else. And for whatever reason, it seems like you can get off of conveyor belt A very easily if it's not meeting a very standard format. It seems like your loan can go unfunded or unwanted even for months. So I guess what is conveyor belt A? What is the desired product? And if it gets outside of that matrix, how hard is it for the lender to want to spend time on that?
Well, to go to your last point first, and we mentioned it on the first segment, it's the fear in the marketplace of making a mistake. So if you're not in a mid to high 700 credit score with a relatively low loan to value, 80% or under, with absolutely no dings on your credit, a very good job stability record with some cash, and by the way, not self-employed, then you could have issues. I mean, even somebody in that particular matrix can have issues. So it has to be pristine, and it's all the rules, again, coming out of Dodd-Frank and the CFPB that is driving fear and uncertainty to the lenders.
Yeah, and what you just said is basically QRM is already in place, even though it's not law, because everyone's afraid that if they do something wrong, they'll buy back the loan.
That's right. It's loan repurchase. And by the way, you know, Fannie Mae is still kicking back loans. We do loan purchase rebuttal for our lenders as well. So when they get a loan kicked back, we've seen cases where lenders are being asked to repurchase a loan on rules that weren't even in place when the loan was made. Highly unfair, sure, and that's happening.
Wow. It dawns on me that if I was a lender, and I don't know, I'm a private lender, and I watch this going on. I was a part of a city that I live in, sort of a foreclosure task force, and I mean, I was on the farthest right-hand corner you could possibly be, because a lot of the suggestions were, well, can we teach classes on how to get people to stay in their home longer and things like that? And I was going, how about teaching two classes? One is that if a lender isn't getting paid payments, it's perfectly within their right to foreclose on the asset. And the other course is that the person that's going to be foreclosed on will get a chance to buy again. You know, What frustrates me about this whole experience is I don't think we've learned anything.
I would agree with you. I think you're asking me a personal question. I'll give you a personal answer on this. We are not letting people fail. We are teaching people that the government is always going to be there to bail them out in one form or another, whether it's through extension of unemployment benefits that go on for 2 years because the government's holding up job creation, or the government is going to step in and help you with a loan modification. Somebody is paying for that. Nobody suffers the consequences of their own decisions anymore. Now, that's a broad brush statement, but that's absolutely a fact. And what we've done is continue to create false bottoms. And you know well, if we want to get values back up, they've got to hit a bottom. Now, we're probably very close, and we may be there now. But people were saying back in 2008 and 2009, oh, we're going to hit the bottom in 9 or 10, and it just didn't happen because the government keeps stepping in to cushion people's fall. And it never works out well. A government solution to an economic problem never works.
and as we touched on in the first segment, they're so far in now, I think the stepping back gets more and more painful the longer they wait.
Well, it does, and it gets more difficult for them to do because they keep promising, and then you got to break promises. You know, you have people where they're not even being prosecuted today for doing strategic defaults. I mean, that's just amazing to me. People can walk away from their house and go down the street and try another loan, and the fact that they walked away is not being held against them. So, I mean, it is an absolute mess out there in many areas.
Well, you know, one of the things that got us into the mortgage mess was we had stated income loans. But now that you have people on the other side of that trying to get short sales and loan mods, you have, I think you would have stated hardship. That might not be accurate.
You know, I don't know. That's very funny. But I don't know what the percentage is today, but I will tell you there is still a relatively, it's under 50%, but it's a high percentage of the stated income and loans that are still paying on time. The loan products were not bad products. They were made to the wrong people. They all started taking advantage of those. I remember one testimony that I did. It was on November the 19th of 2008. It was right after I had become chairman for the 2009 year, and it was in front of Senator Dick Durbin. And one of the disagreements, heated disagreements we had that day, was about whether or not we should continue to make 100% loans to people. And I said, yes, there are still good 100% products out there, and he couldn't believe it. And I said, well, and by the way, this is on tape, on C-SPAN, and I said, Senator, VA loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there and looked, and I said, VA never left its charter. They underwrote the credit and the collateral. They held to exactly what they were supposed to do, and those loans are some of the best in the servicing portfolio. So my point to you is 100% loans under the right product, made under the right credit underwriting guidelines, underwriting the appraisal to the right people, are very good loans.
And I don't think anybody is paying attention to that, because probably the part we're afraid of most in a qualified residential mortgage scenario is a mandatory 20% down payment. And what you just said is a down payment isn't even necessary if it's underwritten properly.
That is exactly right. And, you know, mortgage insurance, which was there, some MI companies, some very good people lost their jobs. And some very good companies closed their doors. Mortgage insurance companies that had been around for, you know, 20 or 30 years because of this, because of the capital requirements that were being put on them. But mortgage, there are several good companies left, and you can still get a high LTV loan, as much as 95%. With mortgage insurance, if your credit's good, you've got good job stability. So the programs are still available. They're just a lot harder to get today.
One of the things that I've learned by studying economic things is unintended consequences. So what lessons have lenders learned in the last few years that'll shape the loans of the future?
Well, unfortunately, these loans are being shaped for us by legislation. We're trying to have, through MBA, as much say in the shaping of the regulations which shape the products as possible. You know, we want FHA to be around, off on a slight tangent, but you know, FHA has a loan capitalization problem as it exists. It's underwater, and they're raising the mortgage insurance premiums on future borrowers to pay for the fact that they let the brokers run over and get approved and do all the subprime loans in 2009 and 2010. And so FHA, which has been a stalwart for, what, over 80 years, is in financial problems right now, in spite of what they say. But they've got issues. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when they look at their loan portfolio that on the loans they did in 2011 and 2012, I'd be shocked if that wasn't the safest pile of loans they've ever written.
No, I totally agree with that. We're making the best loans we've made in 15 years as an industry. But when the meltdown started to occur and the subprime faucet was being turned off in 2008 and 2009, those brokers out there ran and got FHA approved. And they got FHA approved very easy. And so those loans were still being made to people with very bad credit scores, and they're still paying for that today. If home values would continue to rise, part of that pain will go away. But you can't keep them. And they are raising premiums on future borrowers. So people that are getting FHA loans now and in the future are going to be paying higher mortgage insurance premiums because of the decisions that were made in 9 and 10.
And those fees used to disappear after a certain equity appeared. Is that not true now?
No, on an FHA loan, the mortgage, monthly mortgage insurance was there through the life of the loan.
And was it?
It was an upfront fee that you could either pay or finance, and most people financed it.
Okay.
So there was actually two MIPs, and I think that that is still in place.
Okay.
The mortgage insurance on a conventional loan, once you can prove you're in an 80% equity position or 20% equity position, 80% LTV, you can ask for it to be removed, and in most cases it is.
Okay. One of the things that's very different, and our California market is benefiting by it a great deal, is we're at about a 350 median price. And in Riverside, and that's as a state, we have a high, if you're in a high-value county like Orange County, the FHA loan limit's something like 730. Where I live in Riverside, it's 500. But when we were at a 350 median price coming up in the 90s, the FHA loan limit was 160. So even in my area, it's three times the amount of ability to borrow from FHA than it ever was before. So is there any discussion about that changing? Because I think it used to be some percentage of what Fannie and Freddie were, and now it's almost its equivalent.
Yes, there's still a lot of discussion on that. You know, MBA is fighting to keep those loan limits higher. And, you know, my personal opinion is that the loan limits, that's part of the problem, is that everybody went to refinance even the higher loans into FHA. That's not why FHA was established and not why it was there. It's there to help low to mid to moderate income first-time homebuyers, period. But in order to help bail everybody out, they raise loan limits, and people rush to refinance through FHA because they had lower credit scores. So people with big loans with lower credit scores were allowed to go to FHA. Then when home values drop, that's the problem.
There's been a lot of programs to help the underwater homeowner refi. And is it HARP? Is that the program? And do we have another hybrid of that that's about to come out? Somebody, when I spoke last night, was asking me about HARP number 3 or something like that. I just wanted to ask you if you're familiar with any of that. The ability for someone to refinance something that won't appraise, but they can get a loan anyway.
Yes, they're looking at doing another mortgage bailout, HARP, HAMP. There's a couple of acronyms out there, but yes, the Obama administration, one and several of the senators on the Democratic side, want to continue to help people refinance their mortgage with another refi bailout plan. And, you know, my opinion, it's just my opinion, throwing good money after bad. I think I said before, it's time that people, based on their decisions that they made with the best information possible, stand on their own two feet and either make it or fail. It's not the government's responsibility to bail you out.
Yeah, I remember losing some money in 2000 in stocks, and I didn't have a person to call. I just took my lumps.
And that's the way it should be.
Yeah, it's the way
it's called risk.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of principal is being forgiven in California now. There's mailers going out to people just telling them, okay, your credit line is being forgiven. And I know that's part of the settlement, I guess, of that the foreclosure settlement of something like $25 billion. I wanted to know if lenders were somehow compensated for some percentage of the debt that they're forgiven. Is that part of the process?
To tell you, Bruce, I won't answer that question because I'm not sure, so I won't take a stab at something I don't know.
Okay. Well,
I'm not sure. But
that's okay. The topic of shadow inventory. Let's talk a little bit about that, because it's one of the things that people are most fearful of, and it's changed in what it's meant. Originally in 2000 and I suppose 2008 and 9, it really referred to properties the lenders had foreclosed on but hadn't put up for sale. And then it kind of grew to include the people that were delinquent that haven't yet been foreclosed on. And at some point it even started encompassing upside down owners. So what is your sense in talking to lenders? Are they looking forward at very hard times as far as having to deal with losses from these properties, or do they think the worst is behind them?
Combination of both. I will tell you that a lot of the, when you hear that home sales are up, as you and I both know very well, you actually more than me as an investor, cash is king. So people have started to step back into the market, and a lot of these purchases you see out here of single-family residents are people who are investing in it. They're not single-family owner-occupied homes. So people are buying them up, and they'll end up being sold again as they continue to bet on values to rise, or they'll be rented out. Now, that's not a bad thing. At least they're coming off the market, and they're being fixed up. Property taxes are being paid. So, you know, it's glad somebody is buying them. But there's still a surplus of housing out there in some geographic markets. It's just geographic all the way across the nation. I think, from what I understand, if you're on the East Coast right now, like I mentioned earlier, North Carolina, Pennsylvania's picking back up as far as a home buy, a place to buy a house. Employment is strong there. Texas is off the charts as far as employment and people and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you look at it, the states that are doing very well, Florida's coming back, are the states with very low or no state income tax.
Yeah, they just have high real estate tax.
Yes, they do.
They get it that way.
Yes, they do.
And when you drive around, you get to contribute about every tenth of a mile you have to throw. But anyway, you got it.
Yeah, that's right. That's the toll point. That's right.
I'll tell you what's happening in the California market, and it's a little disconcerting, for especially for somebody who that's really a free market person. But Wall Street has shown up in California with some serious money. So you have, I don't know, 6 to 10 hedge funds, each armed with $500 million to $2 billion, and they're buying virtually everything in sight that they can buy. So this is basically a scenario that happened probably 2 months ago, where we have an REO agent that gave us a call. And he said, I thought I'll run this one by. He said, I had a listing that was reasonably priced in an as-is property. Got 94 offers in the first 24 hours. The high offer was from one of these hedge funds with proof of cash of $194 million.
Wow.
And that's what's happening to almost every property that's reasonable. It doesn't have to be underpriced. If it's just priced at market, an offer is coming in from not just an all-cash buyer like you and I would be. We're talking about hedge funds that are buying things. Their MO would be, okay, we're interested in any house between 1,000 and 4,000 square feet built after 1970. So in our area, that represents good 80% of all the inventory you could possibly have for sale. The problem is, if you're a private buyer with the need of a mortgage, the seller is very often saying, well, that's an iffy sale. I'm just going to sell it to a cash buyer.
That's exactly right. I agree with that. So that comes back to Dodd-Frank, CFPB, and owner's regulations and fear in the marketplace. I have a very good friend who put her home on the market in Washington, D.C. Last week, and she had 8 offers the first day.
Mm-hmm.
Real telling them, this is where it's going to have to be. People are coming in and bidding, and she sold it for, I think, $70,000 more than what she paid for it. That's a hot market. You know, there's no recession in Washington, D.C.
Full employment.
It's full employment. That's right. But I would agree with you that the scenario you just gave, if you have the difference between a cash offer, maybe even at a little less price, as opposed to somebody who has to go get financing and they haven't been pre-approved, you're going to take the cash offer.
Well, oddly enough, the cash offer isn't for less than asking price in some areas, and this is where the aggression comes in the price, is that it's often for higher than you're asking, and it's multiple offers. There was a transformation during 2012, and as you know, we buy and sell houses, and we usually have something like 50 houses available at any one time. And we went from, in January of 2000, having a pretty normal market where we would put a statement into the MLS with the listing saying, we're going to fix this house in this manner, and then actually get to fix it and then put it on the market, and within 2 months it would sell. By mid-year, we were getting offers for, we'll just buy it as is at your price, so we didn't have to do the work. By the end of the year, we were probably getting a half a dozen offers that were aggressively pursuing the property as is, willing to pay in some cities 10% over any possibility of an appraisal reaching that number. And so we put in an addendum when we went into escrow under those circumstances that the appraisal will no longer determine the sale price. And so people that went into escrow with basically being the winning bidder closed on that sale, adding cash over and above the appraisal. And that's what's been moving the market so aggressively, is there is nothing for sale.
Well, I got, you know, overall that's good news from the standpoint of what you're framing here, is that it is taking up excess inventory. That means those people who are investing believe that the market is coming back, that we've reached a bottom in those particular areas, and they're willing to pay for it. And if they're investing in it. So I think overall that's good news.
Yeah, except for if you're the guy trying to buy your first house. That
I would totally agree with you. You know, for every good news, there's somebody on the other side that's not getting what they want.
Yeah, and they can't really compete. Just to give you an example of properties not available in a marketplace, during about 2009, I pulled up properties in an area called Moreno Valley for under $100,000. And there were, actually couldn't accomplish that search, so I had to lower the price to $90,000, and I got about 480 properties available for under $90,000. 2 days ago, I did the search for under $150,000 in Moreno Valley and found 12 houses.
Oh my gosh.
That's how radically... And if you go to a 30 days of inventory, let's say you have 12 available, you have 150 pending, and you have 150 closings in those 30-day period. So what's happening is you have tremendous demand now lighting on 12 houses, or moving to the 150 to 200 category next.
Well, let me turn the tables and ask you a question, if I may.
Sure.
If MBA's forecasts are true, and kind of correlate this to past markets.
Okay.
And interest rates go from where they are today and they go up to 4.5% or say 5%. What does that do to your particular market and environment?
Oddly enough, the last time that happened, it adds impetus as long as people can actually qualify and get a loan. Because you now have a twin engine. You have a price progression and you have a payment progression. And it adds aggression to the buyer. So that happened in the 70s. I was the buyer in the 70s who was patiently waiting for a deal. And as I would go to see new housing tracks, it would go from 59 to 69, and interest rates went from 9 to 10. And it really put the pressure on me to make a decision because I was losing on two fronts instead of one.
And I would totally agree with you. I wanted to see what you were going to say. As I have been through all the interest rate increases and decreases since the 70s, as rates start to tick up, buyers look at that and they go, oh my gosh, I better get off the fence and go buy a house. And so I look at it as a motivator in many cases and in many markets.
As long as you'll say yes to that buyer, and that's really what ends up ending the cycle, whether it's at 6% or 16%, it's the lenders eventually say no more often than they say yes. One of the things, David, and we got a minute and a half, just part of the research we've done, because I was hearing people do presentations saying this is the lowest interest rates we've had for 50 years. A gentleman named Sean O'Toole and I went back to Washington, D.C. and went to the Library of Congress and looked actually in the microfiche, went back to 1850s and began looking once a month on a Sunday for rates available for real estate. And it's a fact that there's no one alive that's ever seen these interest rates. And that is what's, to me, allowing for aggression of price to happen so quickly in some of these markets, is that there isn't a big cost monthly for a $50,000 change in price.
Well, exactly. So what you're describing is a manipulated market by the Federal Reserve. We don't have, you're a free market guy, so am I, but we don't have free markets.
No. And, but well, again, 30 seconds left. But one of the things that you have to realize is unless policies change, and I don't see that happening very quickly, we're going to have price progression that could get us right back where we were very quickly into a bubble situation where we're going to have losses again.
Yes, we don't learn from our mistakes. I think you said that earlier, and I totally agree with you. So they need to let rates rise and let the market find its own level and reduce regulation and get out of people's way. We're way overregulated right now. The pendulum just swung way too far this time, Bruce.
David, thanks so much again for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Good to talk to you, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.